It's time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday, the 5th of December, 2015. Island Life is Waiheke Radio's weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, and it's brought to you with the support of the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oniroa. I'm Chris Walker, and on Saturday the 5th of December, I spoke to Rhiannon from Waiheke Library about their coming summer program. I previewed a couple of council-sponsored Christmas events and replayed an interview with local historian Paul Monan on governance on Waiheke. So now I'm joined by Rhiannon from Waiheke Library. Good morning, Rhiannon. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good, thank you.
Excellent. And as we move into, well, just a couple more weeks of school, I think my kids finish about the 16th or 17th.
High school finishes on the Wednesday the 9th next week.
So the library is gearing up for an influx of kids.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what have you got planned?
Well, we've got the summer reading program back this year, which is called, which has been called Dare to Explore for the last 4 years. And the theme this year is Dare to Unlock the Secret. So we're delving into all sorts of mysteries, the world of spies and coding, and ancient mysteries and all sorts of fun, cool stuff like that. So we have just received yesterday, hot off the press, our activity booklets, and they're absolutely stunning. We are gearing up, ready to start on Monday, because we start the program off before the kids actually finish the school holidays.
And so the program works, doesn't it, so that the kids can kind of drop in and drop out throughout the summer break? And
It's incredibly flexible. You can join up any time throughout the holidays. You can sign in any day that suits you. Basically, you can pick the program up, sign up for it, pick it up, go off on holiday, do activities while you're on holiday, and then come back in and just check in with us when you get back. And we have our celebration party on the 23rd of January.
Excellent. And do you find that a lot of kids do pick it up and run with it?
Absolutely. Yeah, there were over 9,000 kids across Auckland last year who took part in the program. It's growing every year. That was up, I think, about 3,000 from the previous year, so it's really gained momentum. And basically, on the island, so for the kids who are hanging around on the island over the holidays, we have several cool events that we've put together, which actually help them complete the program, as well as being lots of fun. The first of those is actually part of our digital club. So on Sunday mornings, every Sunday throughout the year, we have a digital club running, which is really getting very popular. That's from 10:30 until 12 noon every Sunday morning. And the first activity, which is connected to Dare to Unlock the Secret, is an hour of code. I don't know if have you heard about that?
No.
Well, an hour of code is an international movement which is trying to encourage children to develop an understanding of programming and coding, because it's being acknowledged that that's the way of the future, that people actually creating content is the way to go. So an hour of code at the library is going to be looking at Minecraft and Flappy Bird. Want to design your own game? Would you like to design your own version of Flappy Bird? Come on down to the library if you're between 5 and 12 years old, 10:30 to 12 noon on Sunday the 13th of December, and get involved in that. And you get a certificate at the end of it to say you've completed the hour of code activity.
Excellent. So what was the date of that one again?
That's the 13th of December from 10:30 until 12 noon. Yeah. And then the following Saturday on the 19th, so that's the first weekend at the after the young kids finish school, in the afternoon from 2 to 3:30 we have an event called Time Trek, and that's going to be taking the kids on a journey through time to do all sorts of fun activities based on dinosaurs and New Zealand prehistory. So heaps of fun with that one. A little bit of time travel. And then we take a short sort of break over Christmas and New Year. We don't have any events during that period. The library, however, does stay open. So just to say that the only days the library closes are the actual stat holiday days. So in December, that's the 25th and 26th and 28th of December we're shut, though on the Sunday the 27th we are open. And then in January, on the 1st and the 2nd and the 4th, the library is closed. But again, on Sunday the 3rd, we're open. So otherwise, we're fully operational all through. But our next event for the DARE program kicks off on Wednesday the 6th of January. So that's the sort of first week of January back. In the morning at 10 o'clock until 11:30, we've got mind-bending water wonders. So we're going to be exploring the mysteries of water and unlocking the secrets of water. And it's going to be wet and lots of fun.
We've got the great courtyard space to utilise now as well, haven't you?
Yes. So we can spill out into that.
And I think the library must really come into its own in the summer with those big doors.
Throwing those doors open is really, really amazing opportunity. We're so glad that the building was designed to allow for that. Okay, and then the following week on Tuesday the 12th of January in the afternoon, 2 o'clock until 3:30, we've got Makey Rhythm Games. And that's going to be hand-clapping rhythm games and then hooking the kids up to the Makey Makey kits so that when they clap their hands, they make all sorts of different sounds through the computer. So that's going to be turning a body into a musical instrument, which is heaps of fun. So that's going to be on Tuesday the 12th of January from 2 till 3:30. And as I said, all of those events help the kids complete the program. Now, with a digital club, in addition to that Hour of Code event on the 13th, every Sunday the digital club will include activities which will also help the kids complete the DARE to unlock the secret.
So do people need to sign up to the digital club or can they just turn up?
They can just turn up to the digital club, yeah. You do need to sign up for DARE to unlock the secret. You can do that online through the Auckland Library's website. It's right on the front page. Or you can pop into the library anytime to sign up for that. Now, I also wanted to say about when you're signing up for DARE to unlock the secret, the activity booklet is double-sided. So on one side, you've got a program in English and it's a complete program with six challenge sets in English. But on the reverse side of every booklet, you also have a complete program in Māori. This is new this year. We trialled a te reo section last year, but this year this is a complete program in te reo. It's beautifully produced. There's a lot of integrity in how it's been put together. It's called Kia Mai Te Whai, and it's based on the story of Rehua. And so each of the challenge sets relates to the birds and the fishes and the trees, the stars and the insects. And it's just absolutely stunningly produced, a complete program in its own right. And we are actually encouraging people to do challenges from either part of the program so you can mix it up. We have full translations of the Te Reo program in English available for those who don't speak the language fluently who would like to take part in it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So summer's also a time where people like to stock up on books and get a lot of reading in.
Yep.
So are there any changes in operations or, obviously you've got those closing days, but anything else that's different for people over the summer?
Yeah, we extend the loan periods to jump over the Christmas and New Year period so people aren't having to worry about getting books back during that time. So at the moment, books are issuing for 6 weeks. So it's a great time to stock up and have those books for a bit longer to get you through that period. But of course, as you say, we are open all through that time. So if you're wanting to come in and get more books and more materials, DVDs, etc., that's all fully operational as well, and we will do extended loan periods for other materials based on their usual issue period. So yeah, lots of flexibility over the holidays. We'll also have, as usual, all of those stunning displays up throughout the library to help you pick your books, and you're always, always welcome to come and talk to any of us about recommendations as well. So we love doing that.
What those displays? I've used those quite a bit, because they bring particular things to your attention. Yep. In fact, the book I just finished reading was one that just jumped out at me because I walked in a couple of weeks ago and was there. So what are you featuring at the moment?
We change our displays quite regularly. So every 2 weeks, pretty much, a new thing goes goes up. Elle's recently had a lovely one up on counterculture, which has been hugely popular.
Yeah, that's what I got.
I thought that might be
John,
the one.
John Lydon's autobiography, Anger yep. is an Energy, which is great. Yep.
Yeah. Awesome. So, yeah, those displays change, chop and change quite quickly, but they do showcase, as you say, the different parts of the collection. So it's a wonderful way to help people find books. But as I said, librarians are also there to help people find books. We love doing readers' advisory and making suggestions, so that's always a good thing to do as well.
Fantastic. All right, so thank you very much, Rhiannon, for coming in. So do go in and check out that program. As I say, so that's you can get underway with that now.
Yep.
Yep, and do stock up on your books.
Wakey Radio.
So in a couple of weeks' time, it'll be next weekend actually, Sunday the 13th of December is the return of the Santa Parade. It'll be on the Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock down Ocean View Road in Oniroa, this year being organised by Waiheke Youth Voice. And they are after community organisations or any other interested individuals or groups to enter floats into the parade. And they've already got some horses, circus performers and dancers and so on. The local board is supporting that. If you'd like to participate, then you could probably pop in and see Tracy Weston at Waiheke Discovery, which is the new store at the top of Oniroa Village in the old Video Easy building. She's working with Waiheke Youth Voice to put on the event, and she'd love to hear from you. So that's a Sunday afternoon, and preceding that on the Saturday the 12th of December, is another council-supported Christmas event, Carols by the Sea, that showcases the island's singing talent. That's down at Little Oniroa Beach Reserve from 5 till 7, featuring local choirs, school groups, musicians and entertainment from the Waiheke Circus. Now, if any of that needs to be postponed, it will all move over to the following weekend. Well, let's hope that it all is all go. So you've got Carols by the Sea at 5 o'clock on Saturday the 12th, and then the Waiheke Santa Parade at 3 p.m. on Sunday the 13th. And if you'd like to participate in that, go and see Tracy Weston at Waiheke Discovery.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
You're listening to Island Life on Waiheke Radio, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues. I'm going to replay an interview now from earlier in the year. It's always a pleasure talking to Paul Monan, local historian. He just has that ability to kind of, I suppose, you know, what history is all about is looking back to inform our understanding of the present. And this was from a show where we focused on issues around governance. Obviously, that's to the fore at the moment with our Waiheke proposal to split away from Auckland Council. And so we spoke to him about, you know, how governance has rolled out in the past on Waiheke. It might sound like a bit of a dry topic, but he's got some great yarns to spin. So this was from September of this year. Paul Monan speaking to me here on Island Life. So hold on, here we go. We've had a bit of a focus so far this morning on governance issues, looking at the establishment of new dog bylaws, and then talking with MP Nikki Kay about the Auckland Council legislation and how that's rolling out and the structure and so on in the 6 or so years that it's been in place. And one of the things that Nikki mentioned was that, you know, that Waiheke, of course, has gone through many permutations of governance over its history. And here to talk with us about that is Paul Monan, a historian from the island who's researched and written extensively on the island's history. And he's going to give us a bit of a run through of exactly what has happened in terms of governance here since the early days. Good morning, Paul. How are you?
Oh, very good, thanks, Chris. It's very nice to be here.
Yes, no, it's great to have you here. And you've been researching and writing about Waiheke for a number of years now, haven't you?
Yes, my first work started back in about 1979, so, you know, I'm looking at 36 years. my first work was done in conjunction with Dixie Day, who wrote Waiheke Pioneers.
So, I mean, I've been on the island for, 18 years, and I'm in my second lot of governance. You know, when I got here, we were part of Auckland City, now we're part of Auckland Council. But things go back a lot further than that, don't they?
Yes, we have a what's often referred to as an anomalous local government history, in that until 1955 we were the only substantial area in New Zealand that was not completely covered by a local government authority. So that can be attributed to two factors. Firstly, we had a very low population in the 19th century. Our population was generally set around 200, which obviously is too small a figure to really require local regulation. And secondly, of course, we were too far away from any existing territorial authority. And what Nicky was referring to, we are an island. We have, and hence we have particular local government requirements.
So does that mean that before 1955 it was a bit of a free-for-all?
Well, I'll give you a quick timeline. So we had no local authority at all. I must make a distinction here between the all of the island and parts of the island. We certainly had... local government came to parts of the island before 1955. In 1921, two road districts were constituted. Of course, that 1916 to 1923 period was the time of our historic subdivisions, which was a huge turning point in our history. We moved from being a pioneer farming society with a substantial Māori component to a society where we had recreational and retirement subdivisions, plus a large continuing rural farming component. So in 1921, we had two road boards constituted. One was the Ostend road district, and the other was the Oropu road district. So both of them functioned as road boards, which meant that their principal interests related to transport, and they often took up the responsibilities of the subdivision syndicates, who put in the original roads, put in the original wharf, and the road boards took over some of those responsibilities. But the great irony is that left a lot of the more closely settled part of the island still without any local governance. And I'm talking about Onaroa, Surfdale, across to Palm Beach, because a road board was set up as a result of a petition of section owners. And so if section owners collectively didn't want any local government, it was their entitlement not to. So I've always found it very interesting that Onaroa, Surfdale and also Rocky Bay somehow met their roading requirements by simply levying a £1 per section charge. Extremely small sum, but somehow that was enough to keep some type of roading, usable roading system in place. The big drawback was that the lack of a local government meant that that these communities didn't have access to central government subsidies. The subsidies were there, but the condition was that without a road board, there was no guarantee of road maintenance. And it's all well and good putting money into forming a road, but, you know, all of us know heavy winter rains, and we're talking about metalled roads. Very quickly, that work was undone, and hence the central government refused to countenance subsidising the roads outside of those two road board areas. And that continued through There's one incident that I'd quite like to at some point talk about some events on the island.
Yes.
We had two big meetings. Well, maybe I'll keep the chronology going. We had two very important meetings on the island, one in 1938 and one in 1945. And it all stemmed from the concern of William Parry. He was a section owner on the island, who also happened to be the Minister of Internal Affairs in the first Labor government. So he was a big wheel in Wellington, also had an acute interest in Waiheke, and in 1938 he expressed real concerns about our roads. We still didn't have an arterial road system. He was very concerned about this lack of governance on much of the island, and he organised a meeting of section owners in 1938 at the Ostend Hall, and sent his senior civil servant, Joseph Heaney, who was the undersecretary, sent him up to Waiheke Island. And I was quite fascinated when I read Heaney's account of this meeting. He got off the ferry at Surfdale Wharf, and this is 1938. He was met by Jack Kennedy in his 1920 Hudson motor car. It was one of those big flashed heavy touring cars of the 1920s and 30s. That was one of the few motor cars on the island. So Heaney was picked up by Jack Kennedy and driven to the hall at Ostend. Now, this was well before the day of the causeway, and so the route was up to Pacific Parade at the top and down Hill Road, Te Toki, and through. And Heaney recorded a scene of humble, physical, strenuous Waiheke Islanders trudging through the mud. First of all, I was touched by the humility of these people. This is the 1938, the population of the island would have been in the vicinity of 1,000. A lot of these people were retirees. We still didn't have anything like a commuter service into Auckland, so they were locally employed in one capacity or another. Quite a few men were working for the Public Works Department on roading in 1938. We've got these humble people, no motor cars, all walking, and Heaney, of course, was absolutely shocked at the state of the roads, and it confirmed his conviction that we needed a comprehensive local government authority as soon as possible. And then he arrived at the hall, found 200 people were there. I suppose I'm highlighting again just how dynamic politically our society has been for a very long time. These were people who got there the hard way. They didn't drive, they walked. Clearly, there'd been a lot of rain, so they walked through the mud, but they were still determined to get there. And so Heaney just laid out the options, whether they wanted a road board for the whole island. A road board could be set up just by a petition from the section owners, whereas a council has to be constituted by Act of Parliament. I might just quickly skip. That was one meeting that didn't...
So just to clarify something there, I mean, so was the drive of the people of the island then, did they want the roading subsidies, or did they want a council?
They wanted their long term objective was a council. They certainly didn't. I'll quickly jump to the second meeting in 1945. Mm. Heaney came back, and what's very interesting, Heaney then, he said, look, we've got a road board for the whole island, we've got a council for the whole island, or you could consider amalgamation with Auckland. And interestingly enough, the Auckland amalgamation option was thrown out by a vast majority. And I might, I've just opened my, I was flicking through my book, and there was actually quite a good little section here on local government. And I noticed that I quoted a statement by Frank Brown. Frank Brown, in 1945, had just retired as the chairman of the Ostend Road Board. He'd been chairman for 20 years. And he said this: nothing Heaney said made me believe that joining the city council would be the best thing for the island. We want a separate island county, and we don't expect to get roads repaired, drainage or other things installed all at once. We want to get along quietly and control our own affairs. Now, this is exactly the same spirit we've got in much of the community these days. The only difference now being, I don't think people are as patient about waiting for road improvements and so forth. We're all rather spoiled, and a lot of us want to play it both ways. So the county, by 1945, there was that wish for a county. But still, things were still in suspension because of opposition from... There still was a reluctance to accept the increased money that rating would produce over the very modest £1 per household in the non road board areas. We have been a budget conscious island for some time, and for good cause, I think. Inhabitants on this island have been people of modest means.
So, I mean, it's interesting that the focus is so heavily on roading, and I suppose there is still, you know, those who say that the function of council should be roading and rubbish collection. And it seems, you know, some of the other things that we might now associate with council, I don't know, like libraries and recycling and, you know, cleaning up the streams and all of this kind of stuff, it seems like that was much less of a concern back in the 50s.
Well, the level of regulation was much lower than what we've now come to expect and have to accommodate. Another sort of anomaly in the historical background that I've outlined is that there was actually very little in the way of formal planning controls, but even about building construction. And hence people like me, my experience of the island goes back to the early 1970s, and when, you know, there were a lot of quite unusual looking batches, and it all reflects the fact that the road boards didn't exercise much in the way of building planning control, and certainly if you were outside a road board, there was no control at all. And hence, for example, when the army huts became available and Stony Batter was decommissioned, when we've had a lot on the island, and, you know, these were simply bought for £20, something of that order, and put on a section with no authority paying much attention to what was going on. And that spirit, I think that independent spirit where we don't expect, we'd like to live in a situation where council does less than more, you know, was still alive.
So if we go back to this meeting in 1945 and kind of pick up the chronology, so they were, you know, people were presented with those three options, the roading board, a council or Auckland, and you said that people were very firmly of the view that they weren't to be part of Auckland. I mean, where did things proceed from there?
Yeah, now, 1947 is a big year. Finally, there was a consensus in the community that the developed part of the island had to be included in the one road district. So 1947, the Ostend Road District was expanded to include all of West Waiheke. And I'm talking here about Surfdale and Onaroa. So 1947, this road board was renamed the Western Waiheke Road Board. At least it covered all the developed part of the island and with some sort of provision made for roading. In the 1950s, we've got to keep in mind that the eastern, central and eastern part of the island was still without any local government authority. In the early 1950s, the farmers were holding out, largely because of a reluctance to accept rating. But there was a very interesting incident in 1953, a road dispute that's been forgotten in our community memory here pretty well. A roading dispute at Pymelon Bay. The owner of Pymelon Bay and many, some hundreds of acres beyond was a man by the name of Drusy Arnage, and he got very understandably annoyed by the frequency of people going through his gates and leaving them open. Now, Pymelon Bay, and I'm talking about, you know, the top of Waiheke Road, that T junction. This was a key junction on the island, and which was on his property. The road passed through, so he became very angry about these open gates, and he dug a trench across the road. It's a precursor, really, of what. Those of us who were here in the 1990s, the precursor of the John Spencer Road issue that engulfed all of us in that decade. So he dug a trench. He didn't build a mound. He dug a trench across the road, and that caused a massive crisis. At the eastern end, none of the farming families could get their children to school. There was a school at Onatangi, nor could they get to the Ostend Wharf. And what happened was very dramatic. It involved a firearm, and it involved the Onatangi pub. It had all the makings of a Carson City, Western 1880s drama. A neighbour, I won't name him. I have named the property owner who dug the trench, but I think that's well accepted history. I won't name the neighbour. The neighbour is, according to local law, that the neighbour phoned Drusy Arnage and said, "Look, I think we've got to sort this out. Let's have a meeting down at the Onatangi pub." So Drusy Arnage went down there, waited at the bar, and then the neighbour turned up with a shotgun. And he put the shotgun on the bar, and he's alleged to have taken three cartridges out of his pocket and put those on the bar next to the shotgun. And he said, unless we can sort this one out and you stop blocking this arterial route that's important to all of us, this one's for your dog. The dog must have been quite bothersome to neighbours. This one's for your dog. This one's for you. And then you picked up the third cartridge and said, "And this one's for me." But that pretty well, and Drusinich fled the bar. But what's interesting that was the time when the local government commission was writing a report on Waiheke's local governance requirements, and cited this case in its report and said, "We really need to have an authority here that will preempt any repeat of this type of incident." Its concern was about the pastoral production from that two-thirds of Waiheke Island. Sheep farming was still profitable. In fact, because of the Korean War, Waiheke's wool bales were receiving top prices. And so that led really to the creation of the 1955 Waiheke Road Board, which covered the whole island. At last, there was some sort of local government structure for the whole island in 1955. I sort of raced through the rest. We all know, I think, 1970 to 1978, we had a county council.
So that was 78, yeah.
1970 to 1989.
Yep.
1970 to 1989, yep. Just shy of 20 years, we had that that county council that had been advocated, and that's really what the Waiheke Islanders had wanted from the 1930s onwards, a lot of them. And then we had amalgamation in 1989, and then the super city, I think, is it 5 or 6 years ago.
So once we got to the county council days, I mean, local government does tend to throw up some colourful characters, doesn't it? Are there people who kind of stood out throughout that period as really kind of making a significant mark on local politics?
Well, for my vintage, of course, there are two figures that, were rather than being famous, sadly, were infamous. And it's a shame in a way that we focus on, you know, on individuals because of some misadventure. We had two chairmen whose behaviour led to difficulties, and I'm thinking of Kerry Greer. He was the youngest chairman of a county council in New Zealand, but somehow he got involved in in some activities that involved drugs, and he was charged and convicted of drug misbehaviour. And
whilst he was in the chair,
yes,
yeah,
and he had 8 years in prison, and extremely. I can't say I knew him well, but I met him on a number of occasions, and he was a bright young man. Legally trained, he was doing quite a good job as a farm manager. He managed the O'Brien farm, and I'm talking about that area, Rocky Bay, where the present Onatangi Sports Park is. Pūtekil Kahu, extremely important part of the island. He managed that quite successfully in the 1970s. Then, of course, we had Ron Gay, who succeeded Kerry, and he was charged with smuggling offences. And it's a colourful local government history.
So I suppose in those days, I mean, boats, you know, coming down the Gulf, I mean, it would have been a pretty good staging point for bringing goods in from offshore, wouldn't it?
Well, both those unfortunate cases did involve yachts. I think Kerry Greer off Pūtekil and Ron Gay, of course, had he owned a lodge down at Orapu called the Blue Heron. And I think a yacht that had come back from a Pacific voyage was involved in that. It would have been moored off Orapu.
So did those kind of controversies, were they, you know, what, did that create a local drive for change in governance, or was that move to Auckland Council, was that as kind of, I suppose, as firmly resisted as perhaps the latest amalgamation was?
I still remember transport issues, roading, as being so important in the 1980s. One difficulty we had here, I mean, I've talked about the lack of local governance for many decades, which meant a lack of receipt of central government subsidies, which of course had to mean in 1970. Our roads were in very bad shape, and what had added to exacerbated the issue too was the amount of money that was was put into the into Kennedy Point by the road board in the 1960s, and then by the council in the early 70s, and so we had a real backlog of work on our roads in the 1980s, and also we had problems with Matete Wharf. It's all covered in my book. It was quite clear by the 1980s that a county council with a very small rating base had no show of developing or of maintaining, much less of developing, this critical transport infrastructure. And I think we need to. I'm hesitant about this de-amalgamation initiative because, to me, you know, I tend to agree with what Nikki said, that our requirements here, our infrastructural requirements exceed that of a standard community in New Zealand with a population of 8,000 because of the large number of tourists we get here. We're handling a lot of the movement of a lot of outsiders as well as ourselves, and that even if we just reduced it to that issue, this is something that has to be really thought about deeply.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, you've mentioned a couple of incidents there that so much of this comes back to you know, to roading, transport and related issues, whether it's the shotgun incident at Onitangi or the, you know, the Spencer Mound out towards Stony Batter, or, you know, disputes over the turning key at Matiatia. It all seems to come back to roads.
Yeah. And that really comes down to being an island, that we have to get to node points where roading and road transport and sea transport come together, and this can you know, produce log jams, and we can't just drive off this island. We have to engage another form of transportation.
Yes.
And, of course, what's interesting about this island, from my point of view, is we've got, apart from being an island, we also have a lot of historical anomalies, given the way that this island was settled. And again, I can go back to the Spencer road difficulties of the 90s. Our original roads were paper roads that went up valleys to enable the extraction of timber. Right from the start, we didn't have a publicly authorised roading system that went around the island. We had a combination of reliance on small craft to get from bay to bay, and then roads going up valleys. But there was no initial planning for the type of roading system that we've needed since the 1940s, and hence, in the case of John Spencer, there wasn't a watertight public easement on the title of his property. That was in the course of being sorted out. In other words, one of these historical anomalies having to be resolved very late in the piece. So we've also had those difficulties coming in and complicating the work that a local government authorities have been required to tackle here.
So I think maybe just finally to round off, I mean, we've heard about, I suppose, some of the infamous characters. Are there people who stand out on the other side of the scale? People who have demonstrated, I suppose, you know, foresight and great leadership throughout our governance history?
Well, I've I mean, I'm prepared to name some people I've known. Gordon Hodgson, I think, was a marvellous community politician. He got involved in a wide range of activities. I was involved in the setting up of the Estonia Banter Protection Society. Gordon came on board and he handled all the documentation for incorporation. I remember him early in the piece saying, well, you know, this is not a particular interest of mine, but I'm very happy to come on board, because he played a big role in the fight to open the Loop Road. Gordon is close to the top. Mike Lee, Sandra, Rob Delamore, whom we lost not so long ago, did a sterling job on the council in the 1980s. There are many more. Don Chappell. I mean, I that's why I think I would far sooner focus my attention on those islanders who've contributed so much. Without being infamous, without attracting journalistic headlines and so forth.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, thank you very much for coming in, Paul. Your book, Matiatia, Gateway to an Island.
Yeah, Gateway to Waiheke Island.
Gateway to Waiheke Island is still in print and available. You can go down to take yourself a copy of that.
Yep.
What about your earlier books? Are any of those still in print?
Sadly not. Waiheke Island to History, published in 1992, that went out of print about 2000.
Yeah, but the library have copies of those, of course.
Yeah. It's in the library, and, you know, and time permitting, I'd quite like to write an accessible, overarching historical guide to the island sometime, so maybe I should say watch this space.
Yes, well, please do. It's been a pleasure having you here.
My pleasure.
That's Paul Mullen, Waiheke historian, and do pick up that book, Matiatia, at Take Note. It's a great read.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.